Hello out there, support staffers. This is Chris Miller, your host for the Support Staff Podcast. Welcome back to the fifth episode of the Support Staff Podcast. This week, we will be having longtime friend of mine and video coordinator at the University of Minnesota, Matt Childers, sit down with us and talk about what he has gone through in his small journey through college football athletics, and just talk a little bit about what his life is like outside of college athletics and what it's like inside college athletics. Matt and I go back quite a bit with our history from the University of Wyoming, Houston, and then to the Air Force Academy, but we've always stayed in touch over the years, and it's just been a very interesting way to see how his story and his professional career path has grown along with mine, and it's kind of mirrored one another through the years. So without further ado, let's get into this amazing podcast with the University of Minnesota video coordinator and good friend of mine, Matt Childers.
Hello again, and welcome to the Support Staff Podcast. My name is Christopher Miller, your host, and tonight, lo and behold, folks, we have the fabulous Matt Childers from the University of Minnesota, the Golden Gophers. Matt, how you doing tonight?
Excellent. Thanks for having me. How are you doing?
I'm doing really well. Today was an interesting day. I thought I was going to go play golf and get 18 holes in, but my son got sick and he couldn't go to daycare. So I got to sit at home and do some interviews and get to meet some pretty nice people, as well as get slapped in the face by my son's milk bottle. So it was a good time. How's your day been today?
It's been quite the day. I did not get 18 holes of golf in. Had to go into the office, unfortunately, on a Friday. It was a beautiful Friday outside. It would have been a great day for some golf, but looking for an assistant currently, so we've been interviewing some candidates and going through some things and looking for the next great assistant video coordinator in Minnesota.
There you go. And the premise of this whole podcast is to hopefully get people an inside scoop of what they need to do to get into this profession. Normally what I do is, to begin with, I will hand it off to you so that you can tell us a little bit about your current job and then just a little bit about your background.
Absolutely. I'm the Director of Video Services at the University of Minnesota. Heading into my third season there, been there about 2.5 years now. Been with Coach Fleck for 5 years. So I was with Coach Fleck at Western Michigan. We were there for 3 seasons, had some incredible years there. Last year kind of culminating with, we had a MAC championship and we went to the Cotton Bowl, which is, just an incredible experience, especially coming from the Group 5 level. Before Western Michigan, I was at University of Idaho where I was a student, kind of worked my way up from being a student into being the assistant there. And then when my boss moved on, I was kind of gifted the video coordinator role. I'm not sure if there was other candidates that applied, but I was in place and ready to go and in the office already. So they just promoted me from within and gave me my start. And I couldn't be happier with kind of how things went there at Idaho. But when it was time to move on, I interviewed with Coach Fleck, and it's been an incredible ride since with him. Rowing the boat.
The cool thing for, I think, listeners as well, Matt, you and I feel like we've met one another along the road through college football. Me being at Wyoming and you at Idaho and having the game up in the Kibbe Dome up there. That was definitely a very interesting area to play a football game.
It's been, I've had some interesting stops along the way. The Kibbe Dome is probably one of the most unique environments. I played at the Horseshoe, played in the Big House, played at LSU. There's not too many places that are more unique than playing in the Kibbe Dome.
And for those that don't know about the Kibbe Dome in Idaho, it is legitimately a indoor field, and it's, maybe 120 yards long.
Brick walls are right at the end of the end zone, so it might be 122 yards long. It's not much longer than that.
And I think they added the padding to those brick walls after you left.
There was one specific injury that I remember, and almost immediately following that game, there was padding up on the walls to ensure player safety. As it always goes, something happened and dictated administration getting some very quick movement after that.
The thing that I remember the most too is the sideline shot was awesome. I've loved the sideline shot because I shot sideline and then I edited every quarter. When you showed me the way to get up to the end zone, I literally looked at you and said, fuck that, I'm sending my kid up there. And talk a little bit about that.
It's quite the experience to get up there. It's a straight ladder to get up. There is no lift or elevator or anything like that to help you out. So you're climbing hand over hand all the way up to the top. The Kibbe Dome is, I think, 13 or 14 stories high. and you are definitely at least 9 stories high where the end zone platform was. And then it's a platform. It goes out over the edge of the end zone. So your end zone shot was almost directly vertically above. If there was a corner fade into the corner of the end zone, you might not even know what happened. It's not going to be on your video, that's for sure. There was one game where I was the end zone filmer, and it was an overtime game, and the game ended. And the only way that we knew in the end zone how the game ended was based on the crowd reaction. And we knew that we had won the game because the crowd went wild, but we couldn't see whatever happened. We had to wait till the highlights after the game to watch the play all the way through.
That's definitely one. I remember the filmer telling me, he goes, I kind of wish that I was like locked in to, not fall off there. I was like, yeah, that could have been bad. And he goes, we don't ever play there again, do we? I was like, no, thank God we never play there again. But no, our friendship, I think it started there. And through years of CSVA and just back and forth with shooting the shit over text messages or Facebook Messenger or gifts that you send me, like that's definitely, to be honest with you, you're one of my strongest friends in the video world. So it's an honor to have you on the podcast tonight, and definitely fun to have you as a friend of mine. So
yeah, I appreciate that. It's been quite the ride. I mean, kind of both of our paths, bouncing around all over the place, pretty much all the way across the country sometimes, and then seeing each other along the way. That's most of the fun of going to these conferences and conventions and things like that. Is you get to see these people that you work with daily, but you only can interact with maybe in person once or twice a year. It's a lot of fun.
And I think that's another interesting thing too, is a majority of these people, you only talk to them via text message, over a telephone call, and you've never met them your whole life. And then it was like at CSVA, all of a sudden you're like, oh shit, this is what you look like. Facebook stalking them to figure out like, okay, what's this dude look like? So if I do see him, is it going to be weird? Is it going to be like, oh, hey, dap him up, like bro hug? Or are you just going to like shake hands, but like, let's have a good game. We'll see you later. Like that was always one of the interesting things for myself. So
putting a face to a name is always important. I love the fact that everyone wears their polos, with their school that identifies them, because honestly, most of, the people that I don't, directly interact with, I only know them by school name. So, hey, that's the LSU guy. That's the Ohio State guy, whatever it might be. And it's a lot of fun meeting people and, getting to know them a lot better, and then creating friendships that last a long time for sure.
Obviously, you have a very interesting story. Having been born in Anchorage, Alaska, like a true Alaskan, you play hockey. And also as a true Alaskan, you go back in your summer times and you basically do your own Discovery Channel and hop on the crab fishing boats. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's a family business. I've commercial fished my entire life for salmon up in Alaska. We gillnet for salmon up there, and it was how I put myself through college. It was a summer job. It originally started just because that's what my dad and my mom and my sisters would all do all the summer, and that was kind of what we did every summer. I don't know anything else besides going down to the fish camp and setting up fish camp and riding around in the boats, and then it's become a hobby, a job, and now it's just it's what I know how to do. And I love going up there. It definitely keeps me grounded, makes me appreciate having a desk job, but at the same time, the desk job makes me appreciate being out on the ocean and being able to kind of be free. It's a different world up there.
Especially, you have two daughters, and it's Denali and Bristol?
Denali and Bristol, absolutely. Okay. They're the two Alaskan names. Denali is the biggest mountain in North America, so naturally it's a picturesque mountain. It's not about the size, it's about how beautiful it is. And then Bristol Bay is where I go fishing in the summer, and it's one of my favorite places in Alaska. So my wife kindly agreed, and we are raising our two non-Alaskan native children. They were born in Idaho and Michigan, but they're Alaskan just like me and my wife.
Now here's the real question. Did you guys agree to the name prior to the birth of your children? Or, like myself, did you, wait till your daughters were born and then be like, hey, this is a great name, you're drugged up, let's go with it? Because that's what I did. We were playing around with the name Max, and she said Maxwell. I was like, no, that's an R&B musician from the 90s. Like, I don't want that. I was like, I'd rather him be Maximus because he's a fighter. And she's like, well, we'll talk about it when he's born. And then as soon as he popped out, I knew she was drugged up. And I'm like, hey, we're going to name him Maximus. I'm like, are you okay with that? She's like, yeah. Yeah, that's great. I just need to go to sleep. And I was like, yep. Sign the papers. It's done. So did you go along the same lines, or?
We had decided the names ahead of time. I didn't wait until she was drugged up. I probably could have been beaten up by her after that fact if I had forced anything that was against her will. But no, we both being from Alaska, the Denali name was pretty easy to decide on. Before we found out the gender, and the boy's name actually wouldn't have been an Alaskan place. It was just a name that we both liked at the time. And then with our second daughter, we didn't find out the gender until she was born. And we had two names picked out. And you know, if it was a boy, it was going to be one. And if it was a girl, it was going to be Bristol. And it was a girl, so it was Bristol.
My other question, and this is just kind of a funny thought to me. Do your friends up in Alaska give you any shit for your daughter being named Bristol with Bristol Palin? And I mean, obviously you can see Russia from your backyard. So I was kind of hoping that that would all, you know, tie in.
We're hoping that the age gap, this was a definite conversation between me and my wife. We are hoping that the age gap and the news cycle has died down on the Palin family enough that Bristol will not be associated between the two of them. But I mean, it's Sarah and Todd Palin have a fish site out in Bristol Bay, which is why Bristol Palin has the name. Bristol is actually a pretty popular name up there. Down here in Lower 48, you know, not at all. There's not very many Bristols in the world. I haven't met a single girl named Denali or Bristol down here, but we like it being unique. And hopefully, eventually, the Palins will fade out of the news cycle and Bristol can, you know, charge her own way.
Well, fingers crossed for you there that her daughter doesn't get into politics, because I don't think anyone else in that family could possibly get into politics. But we're not going to go into that whole political debate by any means. Just, you know, a couple other things I just find really interesting with you. So your entire family basically plays hockey other than Bristol. And you say that your wife is the toughest one in the family. So by that, she's a defenseman?
She does play defense. Okay. We both play in the league here. Being in the state of hockey, I mean, it's an incredible place. There's ice rinks everywhere. I mean, I got to drive past three ice rinks just to get to the rink that I play at. We both play in kind of the same league that we have. My wife's like the division manager for the league, so she's very heavily involved with the hockey league here, and she is absolutely the toughest one in the family, save maybe Bristol. Bristol, you know, she's still a little bit small. But Bristol's probably coming up to be the toughest one in the family eventually. But between the two of us, my wife Paula, she is a defenseman, and she will let you know when you're not doing something the way that she prefers it, and that's okay. You know, I appreciate the toughness she has.
Being a hockey family, is the dental bill high? Like any fake teeth, like replacements or anything like that?
So far, so good. I don't wear a full cage. I probably should. You know, knock on wood. It's been I've been pretty lucky so far. But not having played, you know, contact hockey for a long time, we've been pretty we've been spared the teeth bill so far. And hopefully, for the sake of my daughters, they are as well.
So last one, I'll throw at the hockey here. Tougher hockey player, your wife or Chara, the defenseman for Boston, especially with the broken jaw and he played in the finals?
Having a broken jaw and playing is pretty tough. And Chara is an incredible player. He's been playing for a long time. He's one of the best defensemen in the league. But I can't take anything away from my wife. My wife, I would put up against any player in the league. She would hold her own, and she would let you know she could hold her own as well.
You're a very smart man, and you will be still sleeping in the same bed for that answer. So I applaud you there. Just some other really, like, you are a very interesting person when it boils down to it. You worked in the 2010 Olympics in Vancouver?
It was an interesting time for me. It was actually when I was already done with college at Idaho. I was volunteering essentially as the assistant video coordinator at Idaho. They were not paying me a living wage whatsoever. I was getting kind of some stipends and some, you know, small things on the side to be able to keep, you know, ramen on my table, but I wasn't paying rent. So I needed something to do, and the Olympics were up in Vancouver. Vancouver was just a short little drive away. It was something I had actually applied for about 3 years before it happened. Just as I heard a radio ad, you know, hey, you know, apply here if you want to be involved with the Olympics. And I didn't think I would have a shot at it. It wasn't something that was even crossing my mind. And then the fall of 2009, I got a call that said, hey, based on kind of your resume, you're interested in possibly working with some of our digital technology. And I said, absolutely. Whatever I can do, I'll do. Wherever I need to be. I was going to live out of my car because I didn't have a place to stay up there. And at the time, they weren't offering any housing or anything available. It turned into an incredible experience. I met some really, really cool people. I worked at the Sliding Center in Whistler. So we were working bobsled, luge, and skeleton. It was actually the Olympics. Unfortunately, the Georgian luger died right before the opening ceremonies. And it was about 30 minutes after I had gotten off my shift, and being in the radio center for the sliding center, we were the dispatch for all the emergency calls and everything like that. So it could have been a very, very long night if I had been in it. I guess luckily for me, I was not on shift, and I was able to go to the opening ceremonies because of that we were all invited to as workers as part of it, which is why I was leaving my shift early that day. It was an incredible experience being in the Olympics. Some of the people I met, I still talk to this day. We were put up in a cruise ship that they had parked in one of the little towns up there. That was the way that they had housed some people. I got in with somebody that was a little bit higher up in the Olympic committee, and they were able to get me in there. And I had roommates from New Zealand, roommates from Canada. Living on that ship and being able to talk to people from all over the world that were coming together for a cause like that was one of the best months of my life. It was an incredible experience, and got to experience an Olympics that I probably won't ever be able to experience the same way again, and go to some really, really cool events and see some cool people, walk around Athletes Village, see the Olympic torch, that sort of thing. It was really, really a cool experience.
It's awesome that you got the chance to live on a cruise ship, but I think it would have been more of a true Canadian experience if you would have lived out of your car. Because Jewel lived out of her car. I'm pretty sure Jim Carrey lived out of his car. It seems like a ongoing tradition for Canadians to live out of their car before they get truly successful.
Two things with that. One, I did live out of the car for the first week, and the person that I met that was able to hook me up with the housing arrangements took such pity on me. I actually got food poisoning that first week, and I was sicker than a dog. I was still going to work every day. I was pale, and the guy said, hey, what's your situation? Let me know. I can get you some help. And it got me into the cruise ship, which was incredible. But I was living out of my car in the Walmart parking lot for the first week I was there. I think I called my girlfriend at the time and the first night I was there and said, this was such a mistake. There's no way I can do this. I mean, I'm sleeping on an air mattress in the back of a Subaru or something like that. But it was quite the experience. The second part, you mentioned Jewel lived out of her car. And Jewel is an Alaskan. And I don't think you even pulled that. But she is Alaskan, and she is not Canadian.
That's true.
And secondly, she was living out of her car while she was going to my high school in Alaska. And that was, she lived in a different city, but to go to my high school, she had to live out of her car. So that's the Jewel story. It was obviously not the same years I went to high school, but my high school has one of the most famous Alaskans that doesn't even claim to be from Alaska anymore.
And you know what? You just blew my mind. You legitimately, because I thought that she was a Canadian. I feel like the commercial now where the star goes over you and it's the rainbow and the more you know. So thank you. Thank you, Matt.
She sang the national anthem at a San Diego Chargers game, and the announcer said San Diego's very own Jewel. And that was the last time I even thought about Jewel being from Alaska, because if she's going to claim San Diego over Alaska, that's her own deal.
I mean, there are a decent list of great Alaskans that I can think of just off the top of my head. And it's only two, basically. It's Carlos Boozer and Mario Chalmers, right? Wasn't he from Alaska?
Okay. I'm going to start making this sound absolutely incredible. Mario Chalmers went to high school with me. Mario Chalmers and my sister were very, very good friends in high school. The high school I went to didn't have high school sports, so you could play sports for any school in Anchorage. And so he was able to play basketball for the school that he wanted to play for. So he went to high school at my high school. Carlos Boozer is not from my high school, so I won't claim that one. But there actually is a fourth Alaskan that is actually pretty famous, and he's been in the news recently. It's Trajan Langdon, who was just promoted to the GM of the Pelicans, I believe, in New Orleans. Now, I will have you believe, Trajan Langdon is also from Stellar Secondary School in Alaska. So three of the four most famous Alaskans all went to Stellar. I'll call myself the fifth. Four of the five top Alaskans all from Stellar.
Now, do they have a Walk of Fame at your high school and there's a star with your name on it? Because I would hope to God that you have that star and it's in between possibly Jewel and Mario Chalmers, just so that it makes a nice sandwich.
If there is, I haven't been called about it, but they probably couldn't afford my appearance fee. So
plus, you don't have a car to live out of if you drive up there anyways, so you'd probably be staying at a hotel and they don't want that. It's not the truth.
That'd be absolutely too high class for Alaskans.
All right. Well, the other fact that I have about you, I'm going to hold on that till the end because I think that it's very interesting. Like I said, you're possibly the most interesting man out of Alaska that I've ever met in my life. And I have a good buddy from Alaska. He had some great stories, but your stories definitely top them. So, you know, that's
a bar trick. You know, you can go into the bar and you can say you're from Alaska and everyone's going to be, oh, you know, it's unique in this way and this way. And Alaska was incredible, obviously. And there's not, especially, you know, kind of in this Midwest area, there's not a lot of people from Alaska. So that's the bar trick I pull out. I still have my Alaskan driver's license just to prove it to everybody in case they question my stories.
Does it say McLovin on it, an organ donor beneath it, or is it just say your actual name?
It says my actual name, but there is an embarrassing story with it as well. So I don't like showing that one off. I do some crazy hair sometimes for my fishing, and it was during a fishing trip that I had to get my picture. So not my proudest moment at the DMV.
Also, just a fun fact, McLovin technically turned 38, I think, like 4 days ago. So just a
happy birthday to him.
Happy birthday, McLovin. Like I said, obviously, you have a very interesting past and you have a very interesting past professionally as well. You know, working at Idaho, then Western Michigan, getting connected with Coach Fleck, and then also going with him to Minnesota. That has had to have been an amazing ride, rising up the charts like we were talking. How did you go about getting into that, this profession? Because obviously you did it as a student, much like I did as well. Like, how did you go about getting into it as a student? Like, where did you start off?
Well, my freshman year at Idaho, I actually didn't even go to a football game. I didn't play football in high school. I wasn't interested in going to the football games. There was other things going on. There was hockey and whatnot. And I was involved in a couple of different clubs, and I had my night jobs were on the weekends. So I didn't even go to a Saturday game my entire freshman year. And then in the spring semester, I was hurting for cash, so I needed a little bit of money. And in the dorm, there was a flyer that was on the wall, and all that was pictured was a camera. That was all that was on there. And then underneath the camera, it said, "Do you not like paying tuition?" And a number, you know, you had little tag numbers underneath that you could rip off. And I looked at that thing, and no idea what the camera meant, but I said, I didn't like paying tuition. So absolutely, I'm going to call this number and I'm going to see what this is about. And it ended up getting hooked up with the job there at the football team. And that's what it was, is when I was at Idaho, they would cover your out-of-state tuition. And so being from Alaska and paying out-of-state tuition, it wound up being a decent amount of money per semester. My boss liked to joke that we were the highest paid public employees by the hour, because the amount of tuition waiver that we were getting for working 12 hours of practice a week was much higher than what he was getting paid. It was an incredible experience at Idaho. And kind of my boss, Sam Tevens there, really knew a lot of people and was able to kind of put me in touch with a few people that are still working around today. I mean, the old whack that we were in when I first started there, it still has a couple of some incredible guys that are great, you know, people, great peers in the video world, and people that I look up to and I still talk to a lot for help and advice and that sort of thing. So it was a great experience at Idaho. My first job was running VHS tapes to all the meeting rooms. That was the job at the end of practice. We had a little dip net that we'd catch the VHS tape off the camera towers, and they'd drop them off the edge, catch them in the dip net, and then run them into the office. And then at the end of practice, you know, there was a stack of tapes, you know, 9 different 7-on-7 tapes, and you'd run around to all the meeting rooms and drop off the 7-on-7 and the 1-on-1 and the team tape to each meeting room. And, I mean, that was Idaho's technology, you know, back in 2004 when I started. And just seeing the way that the technology has changed, you know, very quickly. The next year we had a server that was capable of a couple of digital editors, and then moving along. And, you know, by the time, you know, 6 years later, we were fully digital at Idaho. So it was a fast and quick switch between the VHS days and the digital days. But listen to some of the other video coordinators talk about the old days and things like that. Like, it's just incredible, you know, listening the way that things used to be. You know, I was fortunate enough that I was still part of the 6 a.m. airplane runs on Sunday morning. And if we got back from an away game and we didn't get the game printed fast enough and I couldn't get the 6 a.m. flight out of the Pullman airport, I had to drive all the way up to Spokane, which was a 90-minute drive. So it took a, you know, huge chunk out of my, we hadn't slept yet. So that was quite the morning if I had to drive all the way up to Spokane to drop the tape off on Sunday. So it's been a wild ride. Digital age of trading video has saved a lot of hours that I think a few people that are just coming into the business don't quite know about.
And that's the interesting aspect of it all, I think, from the reel-to-reel tape where they actually had to cut the edits to make, tape it together and then, you know, process it and everything to Betadex, to VHS, to, you know, the bigger an SD card or like the P2 cards that you'd have to now the SD cards that are out there. Like, that's kind of crazy. I remember when I first had gotten on, they had just moved away from VHS tapes and we were doing the P2 cards and Mike Weinman was talking to me about everything. And he's just like, this is so much easier. It's so much crazier. I was like, whatever, man. Like, am I getting a t-shirt this week? Like, that was my biggest concern. It was just really eye-opening to me because my very first day at the job at WIO as the director was the full switch over to HD. And Exos was there a whole week. Like, they walked me through it. I thought I had everything, you know, I was walking high. And we go film practice. I'm thinking everything's gonna be good. I go to ingest practice. SD cards are blank. So we filmed an entire practice and got nothing. I went to the head coach's office and I said, Coach, just a heads up, there's no practice from the first day of fall camp. And he looked at me and he goes, are you a fucking imbecile? And I'm just like, oh no, this is not good. Pretty sure I had a wallet thrown at me and Exos cowboy remote thrown at me as well. I didn't go far because of the USB connection, but I still tried to dodge it because I was an idiot. But no, to listen to those older guys talk about just the process and, you know, like you were saying, you would have to hop on a plane, meet another video, you know, assistant, swap tapes, and then fly back and get all that and copy it, dub it over so you'd have, you know, all those tapes ready for the meeting rooms. It definitely come an extremely long way from that. And it's, I think it's for the better. It's honestly like the transfer on Dragonfly. I don't know what I'd have to do if I had to drive shit around all the time. Like I'd probably be out of this job a long time ago if it wasn't for Dragonfly. And it's funny to listen to the older guys be like, Dragonfly, holy shit, this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. And I was like, yeah, it definitely is. It's really interesting because from Idaho, you get the call to go to Western Michigan. Now, Western Michigan, talk a little bit about that. What was the experience like for you melding your style together with Coach Fleck and things of that nature?
Well, it was actually quite a interesting transition. So they were looking for a video coordinator right before fall camp of 2013 season, Coach Fleck's first year there. And I had actually known someone that was looking for a job, and so I was trying to hook that person up with the job. And so I talked to Western Michigan's DFO through that process, and it ended up not working out with that person, but we had made that contact and that connection, and we'd kind of talked about the job and what my situation was at Idaho. And I had told him that, hey, you know, it possibly is something I would be looking to move along from Idaho, but I just couldn't do that the week before camp started. It was a new head coach. Coach Petrino at Idaho had just come in. That was his first year. I was about to have my first child. So it was not the right time for me to make a move at that moment. So we got to the end of the 2013 season. Idaho had another bad season, which kind of had stacked up a few in a row. Great people there, great coaches. I love the coaching staff, but I was ready to make a move. It was where I'd gone to college. Everything was stale to me, and I needed some infusion of something new to me. So when they needed another video coordinator at the end of the 2013 season, I called, you know, the DFO right away and said, hey, like, you know, what can I do to make this happen? And I wanted to get down to AFCA, to the coaches convention, to, you know, meet Coach Fleck. And they were coming off of 1-11 season. It wasn't like he was showing this great promise that you know, I saw something and I wanted to get on board and get on while the train was hot or something like that. It was ice cold at Western Michigan. Flew out for the interview. Saw, you know, the upgrades on the facilities that they were doing, got into the room with Coach Fleck, just his passion, his energy, everything that you see on TV and the YouTube and the videos, that is him 100% of the time. And getting into the room with him, there was absolutely no way I was going to be able to say no, but I already wanted to say yes. And so our conversation, you know, was probably the easiest sell job Beavs had of all time. I tried to, you know, play hard to get and say, you know, I got to talk to my wife and wait till the morning. But it was already 4 a.m. Idaho time by the time I was making the decision. And so my wife was asleep. So I told him yes before she even woke up. And then, you know, when she woke up and I got back to Idaho, I was like, hey, you know, we got to pack up the kid and we're moving. It was a great journey. Western Michigan, obviously, you know, we had massive success after that point. We didn't start successful, and that was kind of some of the most fun is, you know, the same quarterback that went 1-11 his freshman season was the quarterback that was 13-0 winning the MAC championship and going to the Cotton Bowl that fourth year that he was there. It was my third season there. And seeing those players and getting to know those guys and what kind of journey that was, you know, beyond the coaching staff and beyond, you know, all the other things that happened, but, you know, seeing College Game Day come to Kalamazoo, Michigan. That was something I never thought I'd be a part of is College Game Day and that experience, especially at a small town like Kalamazoo. And being a part of that and seeing a MAC championship, seeing these guys have success after, you know, being told that they weren't going to be able to do it, being told that, you know, their program was a joke or their coach, you know, was whatever. And seeing it work out and pay off for these guys, it was incredible. I mean, seeing Corey Davis got drafted by the Titans, fifth overall, in 2016, right after the Cotton Bowl. And seeing his journey, you know, from being pretty much an unrecruited kid out of Chicago that had basically nothing to signing whatever kind of signing bonus he got and being able to do all the things that he wants to do in his life now. It was those four short years and being molded by the coaching staff and the culture that we had at Western Michigan. And then being able to bring that culture, you know, to Minnesota. And we came to Minnesota when Minnesota, you know, was having some interesting times. I mean, I wasn't there when it happened, so I have no idea what was going on. But it was definitely not a great time to be, you know, part of the football program. The football program had a lot of bad press at the time. And seeing the way that the culture kind of had to take a while. I mean, it definitely takes a while to get a culture installed. But now that the culture is kind of digging itself in and you know, self-perpetuating now I'm seeing the players really take onto it. And almost what we did at Western Michigan is happening now at Minnesota. And the results on the field aren't there yet, but definitely we see the behind-the-scenes type stuff that we're really proud of.
Yeah, and you guys have some amazing things going on up there at Minnesota, not only seeing what you do coaches film wise, but also your video production is amazing. Your social that you guys put out is awesome. You guys just had a brand new uniform. What was it last year that you guys switched over to the new uniforms? You guys have a brand new facility as well that looks out of this world as far as amenities out the ass, basically. And I know it's definitely a crowning jewel for that facility you guys have, but the stadium that University of Minnesota plays in as well, like that is a beautiful stadium, I personally think. And being from Iowa, seeing, you know, the Gophers play through the years, they had some good runs in the 2000s with the running backs that they had going through there, and to see what had happened to them before you guys got there, and now what you guys are doing as far as changing the culture and having your players buy in, I think that's the biggest thing, especially with Coach Fleck. Such an amazing person, touching story that most people don't even know about. The whole ethos behind the row the boat saying that he has and what it means to him and how he reflects that to the team is just something that I hold in pretty high respect, because that's just a pretty awesome thing. And like you said, for him to be as he is in the public eye, you know, behind closed doors, that says a lot for you guys' recruiting as well. For the listener that might not know a little bit about like Coach Fleck, can you talk about the row of the boat? Because it was something that started at Western Michigan. And I know when y'all left Western Michigan, there was, you know, back and forth as far as getting the row of the boat rights and things of that nature to Minnesota. So can you kind of talk a little bit about the meaning of row the boat?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, row the boat's very personal, Coach Fleck. It's our team mantra. And it's essentially, it boils down to a never give up mantra. It's the idea that if you're rowing a boat, the only way that you're going to be moving that boat is if you're rowing, actively rowing. If you take your oars out of the water, you're just going to sit still in the water and you're not going to go anywhere. And, you know, if you're on a rowing team and people are rowing at different paces, you're going to go in circles. There's no way that you're going to be able to get to where you want to go. So everyone's got to be at the same speed, the same pace, everything like that. But it goes deeper than that too. It all starts. Coach actually lost a son. He had a heart condition when he was still unborn. They knew that the heart condition was going to establish itself, and his lungs needed to be developed to a certain level to be able to operate on the heart. They weren't developed enough when he was born. It was something that him and his wife at the time knew was going to happen. Very, very tragic. Absolutely tragic. Row to the boat didn't start right after that moment, but it was something that he wanted Colt Colt was the son, he wanted Colt's life to mean something. And so he wanted to be to something bigger than himself is essentially what it was. And so that's kind of the germination of where Row the Boat started. It's that idea that no matter what happens to you, if you keep rowing, you're going to get through it. And that's the never give up idea. And so if you row the boat, you're literally in a rowboat. You're looking at the past, which you know what's happened in the past, but there's nothing you can do about what's in the past. You're sitting in the present, whatever you're doing in the present, if you're rowing, if you're not rowing, that's what you're currently affecting. And then the future's behind you, and the future could be whatever it is. It might be a huge storm. It might be sunny water. You might be currently in the storm. You have no idea if you're getting out of that storm, but the only way you're going to get out of whatever you're currently going to get to where you want to go is you got to keep rowing. And so that's essentially what Row the Boat means. There's many, many different definitions and meanings that stem off of that. But essentially when it all boils down, it's never give up. And yes, he is absolutely tied to that. And he takes a lot of heat for it in the press and from fans and on blogs and Twitter and all kinds of things, because it's an easy target. And sometimes I don't quite understand it, because pretty much every team has some sort of, when Chip Kelly was at Oregon, it was win the day, or, you know, it's fight on at USC. There's many, many different sayings and things. And almost every team has some sort of a change your best or winning bell or, you know, whatever it might be. I mean, we had a bell at Idaho, and every single time that you hit a personal best, you'd go ring that bell. And so ring the bell was our mantra. And so row the boat is our mantra at Idaho, but it means a lot more than just go play well on the football field, because it can apply to your life. It can apply to your social life, your marriage, whatever it might be. Rowing the boat will always get you to where you want to be, or not get you to where you want to be. It's a pretty good metaphor in that sense. And so when we were at Western Michigan, we put it on all of our shirts, and we had oars on our jerseys, and it was a part of our team, and our team really embraced it. But when we went to Minnesota, it's not like, you know, Row the Boat was at Western Michigan before Coach Fleck got there. That it means something very personal to him. And so when he came to Minnesota, it was something that he wanted to get. Now, being that Western Michigan was his first coaching job, I don't know if he quite owned the trademark or how the legal, you know, process to that went. So there was a little bit of a legal kerfuffle, if you will, and it was all figured out. I think Western Michigan, you know, was appropriately compensated to make sure that, you know, they could, you know, replace all the Row the Boat apparel and everything else that they had in their stores. And Minnesota was able to get it, and Coach Fleck was able to use Row the Boat in the way that he wants to use it and apply it to our team and apply it to his life. And I mean, his foundation that he does at the Children's Hospital is all related to Row the Boat as well. So Row the Boat is very important to him. It's very important to the team, and it's starting to be very important to our culture as well.
Knowing that he's a very family-oriented person, and he's very emphatic and very emotionally connected to the team, is he the same way with you guys as the support staff? Like, is that across the board? Like, have you seen, you know, being the salmon fisherman from Alaska, row the boat, you kind of get the same idea as far as what's going on there. You know, a lot of people have always asked, and I'm sure you get this question with the interview processes you have, how is the coaching staff to work with, things of that nature?
Obviously, he's been incredible to me and my family, which is why we had a big decision to make when we were at Western Michigan. Western Michigan wanted to keep a lot of the staff there at Western Michigan, because obviously we had some great momentum there. And when he came to Minnesota, he offered me the job, but he offered my family the job. You know, his wife talks to my wife, and I mean, their family is involved with our family. And when we have events, you know, the family's involved. We celebrate every single person's birthday, not just the staff member's birthday, but my kids' birthdays and anniversaries. And I'm sure someone is keeping track. I don't expect him to be the one personally keeping track of all of our birthdays. But when we have a staff meeting and your kid's birthday is coming up that week, you get a birthday card from Coach Fleck. When we have our Christmas party at the end of the year, every single kid that's even partially involved with the program in any way is at that, and he makes sure to say hi to every kid. And he obviously knows the kids by name. Mm-hmm. When my daughter's come to the football practice, he's coming over, and I mean, he's Coach Fleck, he's Uncle Fleck to everybody. But you know, his wife, you know, helps us out any way that she can as well, and so it's a real family environment. You know, family gets tossed around by just about every program, but I mean, he absolutely means it. If we need something, we can go to him. if Heather needs something, she knows that she can call me and we can call her. If my wife has something going on, she's going to call one of the other wives, and all the coaches' wives, you know, really help each other out, and the support staff wives as well. So it's been a pretty incredible ride with him, but it's because of how well he treats it, you know, the family and our family and every family, that, you know, really makes him such a genuine person.
That's where I kind of feel like our career paths have mirrored one another. With coming to Air Force, Coach Calhoun has been the best coach I've ever worked for. And it's exactly like Coach Fleck. Anything family related, he, you know, is there. He knows everybody's name, barbecues, birthdays, bar mitzvahs, whatever it may be. Like, he's going to be there, or Amanda's going to be there. Like when Max had all of his issues, we had 2 months worth of food just because, you know, Amanda Calhoun was putting that all together, and Coach Calhoun's calling me and asking me, is everything fine with Max? How's your little guy doing? Max come to the office and he's like, Max, how you? Oh my gosh, your legs are as big as a linebacker. And yeah, Coach, I've been having him do squats at home, and we're working on push-ups next week, but squats are the big thing right now. But no, I think that is a huge aspect for anybody wanting to get into this industry, especially with the way a corporate America works, or the way that privatized side or freelance, you always want to be part of something that's bigger than yourself. And to be part of a team or a family, I think, is a very huge thing to prospective people wanting to get in, or anybody that's like listening or a fan, because that's another thing too. A lot of fans don't really know what goes on behind closed doors. And for them to know a little bit more inside knowledge of like what a team's like, or how a coaching staff works, I think is a very advantageous thing for the fans to know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in our line of work, you know, the hours that we put in and everything like that, it is a life commitment, and the families have to be involved, or else we wouldn't see the family. I mean, yeah. when we have family dinner, it's because we're not going to be able to make it home, you know, for dinner. And so that is the time to be able to see, you know, our families and our daughters and our kids and everything like that. And so that's why, you know, I think it's important to find a staff that appreciates you and your family like that, because, I mean, sometimes that is the only way that the families can be together, is when you see them at the office. So they should be encouraged to be around. And I mean, within reason, you know, you don't want them interrupting, you know, the things that need to happen in the business that needs to be conducted. If when Bristol runs across the field, I mean, she's going to get leveled. So, you know, we got to make sure that we keep her out of the inside run drills. But, you know, beyond that, like, you know, definitely having the family around and being invited to have the family around has been really important to me.
I mean, you obviously have to teach her, keep her head on a swivel, because you don't want to get crack blocked by a wide receiver. So being a tough girl, you are telling her to keep her head on a swivel, correct?
To a certain extent. I mean, being she's almost turning three, I think the way that the rules are going and blindside blocks are being litigated to the point where they're not being allowed in the game, she might be pretty safe, because I don't think they're going to be playing more than flag football here in about 20 years anyway. So I'm going to consider it good. And she'll throw her own hits the way that she needs to down the road anyway. So I don't think I need to worry about her too much.
Well, let's talk to Coach Fleck, and let's get both the girls and the wife, I think, fitted up with a Visus, just so in case anything happens, you guys have complete coverage, because those helmets are amazing from what I hear. And if Visus is listening, I definitely do need some sponsorship. So we're going to continue to keep pitching sponsorships through the podcast in hopes that somebody's listening.
Best of luck on that one.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. So obviously, amazing career path, amazing background with what you have going on, talking how you broke into the profession, things of that nature. What inspires you personally? What also inspires you professionally to continue on with doing what you're doing in coaches video and video production management?
Personally, what inspires me, especially in the video world and working in football, specifically with the football team, is seeing, kind of like I was saying before, the transition of the young men that are coming in, you know, as 17, 18-year-old freshmen. You know, our freshmen that we just signed to this recruiting class just got in this week, and they are eyes wide open in the building right now. They have no idea what they're about to get into. You know, it's been all recruiting, and you know, they've been being pampered the whole time, and now, you know, the it's going to get real for them here, you know, very, very quickly. And you know, those first weight training sessions are coming up next week, and Dan Nickel, our strength coach, is not the same guy that was, you know, being all nice and coddling them a little bit, you know, over the recruiting process. But seeing them come in from that level and that point, and then maturing to to the point where, you know, they're developing their own, you know, nonprofit organizations, which, you know, we're really big into and things like that, all the way through their career. And, you know, and then seeing them graduate and seeing what kind of person they've become. And, you know, obviously not all of them turn out, you know, into, you know, the five-star people that they could be, but, you know, a lot of people do. And whether it's NFL or, you know, going into their jobs or internships or sticking around and being a GA or an intern or something, you know, it's exciting to see that transition. You know, the college time is one of the, you know, biggest transitions ever in someone's life, and being able to be part of that and kind of see it. And then it's fresh every single year. You get a new group in, and then it's the same thing over again. And so it's a lot of fun being able to see that and being a part of that, and being able to help out in my own little corner and just a little bit, and how video affects them. I mean, it's not the biggest thing in their world, but I like to be involved as well.
It's definitely an aspect that I never truly understood when I was a student filmer. It wasn't until I was a full-time employee, part of the team, that I felt more bought in, you know, not just a paycheck every week and I got free team gear and got to maybe go to Vegas for one trip or something of that nature. But yeah, I agree with you fully. To see the way that these young men come through the program as, you know, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed football players, and then all of a sudden the way that they grow up into men and what they go on to do. You know, our programs are a little bit different with my kids going into, you know, serve the country and things of that nature, but it's equally rewarding. Like you said too, with your players developing nonprofits, that's amazing. I think a lot of people always are overshadow like the glitz and glamour of wins and losses and things of that nature, and don't look at what is actually happening with these young men to see that they are being built into leaders of tomorrow, or business sense, or just people of great character, so that they have an amazing career in front of them. I think it's lost majority of the time, because it's like, well, what did you do last Saturday? Well, we lost. But yeah, but I got 100% on my test in, you know, microphysicists, and I'm going to go possibly try and cure cancer. Like, what did you do? You ate a hamburger? Congratulations, dude.
It's pretty incredible. And I mean, the football team, you know, yeah, we're all there on Saturdays playing football, and we're on that 100-yard field. But, you know, for the rest of the week, like you said, I mean, they're doing all kinds of different things. And not everyone, you know, football is our life, but their life is much bigger than that. And the football program has to be bigger than that because of that. I mean, these guys are with us, you know, for 99% of their time, you know, while they're around their college years. And so, you know, we have to be involved in what they're doing otherwise. And, you know, like our specialists they started, you know, their nonprofit that they do a turkey drive, and they do a diaper drive, and they do all sorts of, you know, different kind of drives like that. But we want to help that out. And so we want to, you know, involve our, but they're the ones starting it. And it's so cool to see that. And you know, see the kind of, you know, the special things that they were able to do as specialists. And then, you know, all the other guys that are doing their own things as well. And it's a lot of fun.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but your specialist also started a Holder of the Year award that is given out every year.
Peter Martell started his own. He was actually the Big Ten Punter of the Year, I believe. So that was an actual award that was awarded from not himself. And the next year, I think he was feeling a little bit lonely, and he wasn't getting quite the same accolades. And he felt that, you know, maybe that there should be a Holder of the Year awarded. And if there wasn't going to be a committee that awarded it, he was going to start that committee himself. And who better than his own name to promote as the first Holder of the Year? And it's actually taken off since then. It's still a little bit of a meme, but you know, every year he gets a little bit of notice, and ESPN runs a story, you know, here and there. It's a fun human interest piece of who the Holder of the Year is, and now it's quite competitive. I mean, there's 130 D1 holders out there that are all competing for Holder of the Year.
I'm not gonna lie, I'm more interested about the Holder of the Year award than I am about the actual Heisman, and possibly a sponsorship from the Martell Award Committee. That'd be great as well. It could be a nonprofit. It'd be an amazing nonprofit. We've talked about what excites you, what inspires you. What would be some advice to somebody that you would give that wants to get into this profession? You know, sound advice that you would give to somebody that wants to really look and dive into this profession.
I think the biggest thing is, first of all, make sure you're passionate about it. I mean, this is not a job that's going to make you rich. This is not a job that you're going to go home on weekends and have, you know, a great life. You know, it is your life. I mean, this job envelops everything about you. And if you don't love that, it's not going to be the thing for you. And that's okay. I mean, there's plenty of other jobs out there. And this job is rewarding in its own way, and that's what you need to be passionate about. If you love helping coaches, you know, get whatever they need to get done by the technology side of things, this job's for you. And the hours are going to be absolutely terrible. The pay isn't going to be equitable to what you think you should be paid, but it's going to be so good for what you want to do with your own life. And that's the biggest thing to me is make sure that you're passionate about it. And then once you have that passion for it, go find whatever, you know, makes you passionate. You know, what job is going to, you know, fulfill that for yourself, because the jobs are available. I mean, absolutely. Every year there's, you know, I think right now there's, you know, a dozen jobs that are available for not entry level, but people that are coming out of college that are very available. And the pay should not be the most important thing to you. It will never be enough pay, ever be enough pay to get rich. I cannot emphasize that enough. But you will be rich in other things besides money. And that's what's going to be the most valuable to you.
Like, that's honestly, if that's what you're going for in this industry, then you've picked the wrong profession at all. Especially like a job that if you're looking for, you know, the greatest time management, like this is a very labor intensive job as far as your time, especially when you're younger, because I'll be honest, I was completely dumb. And I thought that I could drive 30 minutes to go get a meal, and then I'm getting a telephone call saying, where the fuck are you? The server's down or something's screwed up. And it's like, oh, I'm 30 minutes away. So like that wasn't, I got the mentality, okay, I need to be first in, you know, last out. I had that mentality until I honestly met my wife. And then finally, it's like, as I got up and grew in the profession and my rank, it got a little easier that way. And obviously the pay is going to increase as you rise up through the ranks too. I think it's just getting through these initial years that you need to get your licks in, and then you will be rewarded later on in your professional career if this is something that you do want to do.
Absolutely. If you stick it out, that's where, you know, the rewards come down the line. But it is definitely a job where you got to pay the price early. I mean, I volunteered at Idaho for practically 2 years without making any money whatsoever before I was able to get my full-time job. But that's why I got my full-time job is hard work is rewarded, and it is noticed by the people in this profession. And that is what gets respect. And respect is what's going to get you a job. That's what's helped me along the way is just understanding that don't always ask for something, you know, just work your way into it. And eventually you'll find someone that respects it enough to pay you what is necessary to keep you around.
No, I utterly agree with that. Over the years, obviously you've learned a lot of things, but what are some things that you take away from like the peers in your field?
It kind of depends on a lot of things. There's definitely some very specific people and programs that I follow very, very closely that I respect a lot. And I think that they're doing things the right way. And I want to emulate that in my own program. And then, you know, on kind of a grander scale, I love seeing other ideas. And sometimes, you know, it's not everything a program's doing, but they might be doing one thing that's that much better than everybody else. And that's what you want to take away from them. And it's a copycat business. I mean, quite honestly, you know, if someone's doing something in a way that I like, I'm going to take it from them and I'm going to run with it. And, you know, the highlight video world is a cutthroat business. You know, there's a lot of plagiarism going on in the highlight video right now. But if I see a great idea, it's getting the team juiced up, you know, for somebody else, and I can get my own team juiced up the same way, I want to run with it, because, I mean, at the end of the day, that's who I'm answering to, is my team. And I want to get them going the best way possible. But so it's a mix of both. I like learning from everybody else. I mean, obviously, none of us know the best way to do everything. And I think that's important to understand and be humble enough to realize that you don't have all the answers. And there are people that know things way more than you know them. And being able to learn from them and take things away from them and make them your own, too. I mean, it's, you know, it's not always a direct carbon copy of what somebody else is doing, but taking things from here and there and building your own, you know, style and culture the way that you want to build it is, I think, the most important thing to do to build your office the way you want to build it.
It's crazy to see the way that highlight videos have increased and grown, and the amount of money people are spending on cameras and the talent to, you know, run those things. It's crazy to think that what we have come from, what we have gotten to, and I'm sure you can attest to that too, that it's just, it's a night and day difference from when we started to where we're at now.
I think the very first movies that our highlight videos I was making was on iMovie when I was a student at Idaho, and the warp, you know, video effect transition, or, you know, cross dissolve was, you know, about, you know, if I could do a star wipe or something like that, that was pretty cool. And everyone loved seeing it. I mean, people were getting hyped about it. And yeah, absolutely. I mean, just the way the technology, it has passed me by at this point. Like, I don't even try to mess with that anymore, because someone else knows more than I do. And you know, they should be the ones that are doing it, not me.
Well, that is all the time that we have for this week. Thank you for tuning in. Please tune in next week for the remainder of the episode, episode 6, with Matt Childers, University of Minnesota video coordinator. And we will sit down, ask some other questions, get a little bit more personal, and have a little bit more fun. So once again, thank you for tuning in. Make sure to leave a 5-star rating, some comments. And if you have any questions, comments, or concerns for the good of the order, please leave us a voice message through our Anchor app. I will be able to listen and see what you guys want to hear, what you guys don't want to hear, and possibly if you guys have any other suggestions. But once again, thank you very much, support staffers. Really looking forward to this next week's podcast with Matt Childers, and I think you guys will thoroughly enjoy it.
And as always, good morning. And in case I don't see you, good afternoon, good evening, and good night. Thanks, guys. Hope you have a great day.